Hello, my name is Michelle Yunna-Chan, the Wandering Book Collector, and this is my podcast, conversations with writers exploring what's informed their books and their lives around themes of movement, memory, sense of place, borders, identity, belonging, and home. The Wandering Book Collector podcast is supported by Cox and Kings. I'm joined by the writer and scholar Ngugi wa Thiong'o. His numerous books have included Wrestling with the Devil, which reflects on his imprisonment back in 1978. He was held for a year in a maximum security prison in Kenya without being charged for a crime, without trial. He was thrown in prison because of a play he wrote for community theater. While Ngugi was incarcerated, he wrote his first novel in his mother tongue, Gakoyo. The name of that book, Katani Mutarabaini, its title in English is Devil on the Cross. Other books include Weep Not, Child, The River Between, A Grain of Wheat, more recently, Birth of a Dreamweaver, a memoir of a writer's awakening, and of his time at school in the House of the Interpreter, more recently, a novel in verse, The Perfect Nine, the epic of Gekuyo and Mumbi. He's so prolific, I could go on and on. Ngugi, welcome to The Wandering Book Collector.
Thank you.
Ngugi, you've moved around the world as a student, as a writer, as a teacher, and as someone who's been in prison in the country of their birth, Kenya, and who spent years in self-imposed exile, now living and working in the US. Where is home?
Oh my God. There was a time when I thought I knew where home was. And when I was growing up in Kenya, I was born in Kenya in 1938. And Kenya was a British settler colony. And so the land occupied by Black people was on one side of the railway line, and the one occupied by British white settlers was on the other side of the railway line. Okay, you know, I grew up, I was born in a big household, father who had four wives, or whom I call former. He had four wives, but for us, they were our mothers. So I think I like to think of, we had one father and four mothers, right? So we grew up really now in a large compound, you know, we, like one big family, yeah? But all the community around was also a family, yeah? But later when my mother and my father separated, and we became a one-parent household, that's my mother's household, we moved to another area, but within the larger community, okay? So I always thought my home would be there, Limuru, where I was born, when I grew up, where I knew everybody, I knew every path, more or less, you know. Although later, in 1955, when I went to Alliance High School or high school, when I came back home, I found that the village, which I used to call home, had also shifted to yet a new village, which was a kind of concentration camp or British concentration village, right? So I thought I knew that Limuru was my home, where I was born. And my imagination was, later I would grow up, get married, get children, and my children would build houses near me. So now and then we'll be having this. My dream was we'd be having this family assembly, you know, right? But it never was like that in reality. In reality, I went to high school, which is a dorm for residential kind of schooling for 4 years. Then I went to college in Makerere, in Kampala, Uganda, which is a neighboring country, right? Then came back home and then to England from 1965 to 1967, came back home, and I thought I would settle now and with my family now and my children, some of whom were already born when I was a student in my career, would now create that family I'd already dreamt of, you know, one village community. But things never seemed to settle for me. Because soon after I started as a journalist, I had problems with the Kenyan government at the time. And I went on a mini exile in Uganda and then America. Then I came back to Nairobi in 1972. Then thinking now, I have a job at the University of Nairobi, chair of the Department of Literature. This is a time to settle, right? I even built a house in the village in readiness for the big family or what something to call home. And then I get December 1977, I am taken from my house to a detention camp or to maximum security prison. Committed maximum security prison. So what I'm trying to say, I've never been able to settle in a place I thought was home. I've been on the move throughout. From prison, I came back and then was forced into exile, right? From 1982. And in exile, I always thought I'd packed my things ready to move back to Kenya. I dreamt of what I would do when I go back to Kenya, right? Now, I never went back until 23 years later. And then when I go there, 11 days into being there, we were attacked by armed gunmen, engineered by the state, right? So it's running away again back to into exile. So the home I always dreamt of is not there, but I found a home wherever I go. I've lived in many places. I've lived in Sweden. I've even got a son in Sweden, Bjorn. I lived in England for a long time, made friends there, felt at home. And for the last 23 years, I've lived in America, California, which I think is more like home to me, right? So the home I dreamt of is always there in my mind, but it's never there, Ryan. Yeah. In it, I feel at home wherever I go.
Is there something, Ngugi, is there something about this movement, this motion that acts like an engine for your work, mm-hmm. kind of propels you, or has all this kind of forced migration or sometimes voluntary migration a consequence of politics, moving to escape persecution or take up work opportunities? Has that been, you know, at best an inconvenience, you know, or at worst?
Yeah, for me, really, I mean, genuinely, home was where my mother was, right? Because I associated home with my mother. Then she died when I was in exile, and I could not see her, right? I could not go back to bury her. Her name was Wanjiku. And yet, ironically, the very fact that I've been away from Kenya makes me think of Kenya all the time. And I can see my work, nearly all my work is based on Kenya. I was based in Kenya and on Kenya, right? So although I've been away from that home, but it's still there in me, yeah. But I cannot deny that California has been home to me. Yeah. The many people I meet here of different languages and nationalities and religions and color of the skin. And I like to think of myself as a nomad who never, as an intellectual nomad, right? How about that? Yeah.
And as a writer, Ngugi, what do you miss of Kenya?
Well, I think what I miss most, yeah. You see, somewhere in my writing career, I started writing in English, as so many African writers do, write in English or French or Portuguese or whichever was the language of colonialism. But I broke away from when I went to prison as a result of writing a play in Gikuyu for a village community. My views on language completely changed. And I write in Gikuyu more all my novels since 1977, all my novels and short stories and drama have been, and poetry has been my mother tongue in the Gikuyu language. The only thing I've written in English since then were memoirs. Yeah, okay. So what do I miss? That's what I miss most, to be in a place, to be part of the Gikuyu language community. Because as a writer, what you say in a bus, when you're traveling by bus, or in a marketplace, or in a shop, or along the road, those little, I don't know, whatever they say is part of my inspiration. So I miss that language community, a living language community of Gikuyu speakers. I don't have one in California, right? And I cannot call telephone communication as a language community. Yeah.
That reminds me, Ngugi, of a passage from Wrestling with the Devil where you note this. Writers need people around them. They thrive on live struggles of active life. In writing a novel, I love to hear the voices of people working the land, forging metal in a factory, telling anecdotes in a crowded matatu, gyrating their hips in a crowded bar before a jukebox or a live band. So yes, rich material, Ngugi.
That's what I miss most. That's true. It describes my inspiration. And I miss a lot the changing terms in Gikuyu language. You know, language changes all the time. And as a writer, you need to be aware the language is changing all the time. The new phrases, the new, I mean, all those things help you. So I'm a writer in Gikuyu language who lives in an English-speaking environment in California, you know. But at the same time, it is interesting that I'm always in search, because I'm exiled from that language, I'm always striving for that language. I'm trying to be in communion with it all the time. Yeah. It's the irony. I'm far away from it, but I try and somehow or other be in touch. But I do miss actually being in them. What I liked most when I lived in Kenya was just marketplaces, or even drinking bars where people, whatever people are gathered, I always found it very, very vibrating and very vibrations of life there, right? I liked just sitting in in Kenya, we have a transport system called Matatu, which is a kind of a minibus. And when you travel in a minibus, it's like you're in a living community. the stories people tell, the confessions that take place there. You feel like you'd write a novel, and I actually did write one novel where a large part of it was traveling a matatu. Yeah, the novel wrote in Gikuyu, Shaitan Mudravaine, or Devil on the Cross. The first part of the novel is really traveling in that matatu and what goes on there, right? So I miss that. Life is, for a writer, life is what people do. It's not what they preach in church or in a lecture hall. It's the little things they do in the streets. The dress they wear, not the formal ones when they are weddings and ceremonies, but ordinarily, the oddities of travel or walk or leaves falling or birds, you know, singing or whatever. Here in California, I do it in my backyard, and I do actually try to commune with the birds, with the doves that come to my backyard, and butterflies and bees and so on. I sit in my backyard and I literally just enjoy looking at them. Yeah. But rather be looking at those butterflies in Kenya and the bees in Kenya and in Ikoyo, where Ikoyo language is spoken. Yeah.
What I read out, Ngugi, was from the book Wrestling with the Devil, which is a version of an earlier work of yours, Detained, a Writer's Prison Diary, which you published in 1982. Why did you want to revisit that work?
I did not actually rewrite it, I just edited it. In an earlier version, there are many documentaries, documentations of prison this, prison that. And I just want to tell the story of, so that what was left was just a story of my experience in prison and the experience of writing the novel Devil on the Cross, right? Yeah, so wrestling with the devil becomes the devil of so many things. There's a devil of the title of Devil on the Cross, you know, but the demons also. When you were writing in Gikuyu language, in the first novel in Gikuyu language in prison, it's, oh my God. The thing I remember most, there's no tradition of novel writing in Gikuyu language. I was writing the first novel in Gikuyu language. But I was so conditioned to doing everything in English that when you try to write in Gikuyu, I'm telling you this is, and I'm not joking, there's a little devil that would come and whisper in my ears, more in my inner ear, telling me, why do you go through all that pain to look for a word you don't have? And I'm ready, I'm here for you. That's, of course, the devil will come in English clothes. The devil will come dressed in English robes, almost reminding me that he is there. They are there. He is there to help me with words ready. So I had to struggle with that devil all the time. Because when you're writing in a language, new language, so to speak, and you're conditioned to write in another language, the challenges may make you feel, oh, the temptation to go back to the other language is always there. Yeah, it's always there. So you have to fight, struggle. I had to struggle with that devil. And I wanted to write about that as well, to bring that out. Yeah. So I wanted next week to be the experience of writing the novel Devil on the Cross in Gikuyu language and under prison conditions. Yeah.
Well, talking of prison conditions, while you were in prison and writing that, it was being written by you on toilet paper, the only available material. You noted this: paper, any paper is about the most precious article for a political prisoner.
Oh, yeah.
Also for one like me who was imprisoned without trial for his writing. Can you remember, Ngugi, how it felt to be writing behind bars, the act actual act of putting the point of the pen on the flat surface of the toilet paper?
No, first of all, to get the paper itself and to get the pen, you know, it's like, in our case, first of all, they made sure that we had no newspapers, we had no radio, and of course, no TV, not that there was much TV in those days anyway, right? And I'm a writer, I'm an intellectual, I mean, books are part of my life. So you're there, no books, no newspapers, no radio, and no companionship, because they don't allow you to be in groups. Let us be in groups for a long time. Also, the excitement of, I'm telling you, it's literally toilet paper. And this toilet paper we had came in, it's not a soft kind that I see advertised on TV here in America, where it looks so soft and delicate and all that. It's a bit tighter, more. Anyway, it was very good writing material. That's why it held the pen very, very well, right? So it was actually fun writing a cool language on this toilet paper, huh? Right? And then other things were become very interesting. But the toilet paper becomes a precious, precious a treasury. It's like a treasury you have, right? It's something precious, toilet paper, holding it, right? Yeah, you know, it's amazing, yeah.
I imagine that your efforts to find a way to write and risk and make and taking risks in doing so was about your recording and your documenting and your not forgetting of the experience. But then I read this line in that book, which was this: writing this novel has been a daily, almost hourly assertion of my will to remain human and free. Mm-hmm. How so, Ngugi?
Because everything in prison, at least in that prison which I went to, sort to dehumanize you, right? It's like being, we live in cells, or at a cell, and mine was, the first thing you get when you get there, when I got to commit a maximum security prison, is not losing your name. Ngugi wa Thiong. The name by which I'd written so many novels. Or the title professor of literature, which I was at the University of Nairobi, right? You're just a number. I think it was K something. 677, or something, or it's just a number, literally a number, right? So, and then you are caged, literally you are caged in a little cage, that's your room, right? You're not allowed to interact with other prisoners except as, say, lunchtime. I mean, it's all, everything's human, really, in, they may not even torture you in the obvious torture methods, but being prison is continuous torture, really. So, and the other thing which I noted is the way sameness of everything. Then you realize life is variety, is colors, changing colors, is things moving, all right? And here, one day is like another day. So,
yes,
you felt you want to break that sameness, right? So writing for me was a way of entering into a world which was full of people, full of color, talking jokes, and so on. It was a way of communicating, almost like I could every night I could visualize my village again. I could see myself walking in my village again. I was free. Imagination made me free. Huh? There was nothing they could do about my imagination. Huh? And that was really almost, I don't ever forget the importance of imagination. Yeah. Because imagination made me free. They couldn't hold that back. There was no way they could do it, right?
And turning to Gikuyu and to write in the
and
language.
A child writing in Gikuyu, and I'm in prison for writing in Gikuyu language. And I'm in prison writing in the same language, which was the basis of my incarceration, with paper provided by the government, with pen provided by the state, with food provided by the state, clothes provided by the state, right? So I was the other way around. I mean, the state was giving everything to write. In a way, I mean, yeah. It's a way of surviving, you know, seeing, looking at things, and then imagine helping you to cope with that reality by creating, I like to think of it as a resistance, by creating kind of imagination, help you to create a resistance against the very conditions under which you are living. Yeah.
I mean, you spoke earlier about wrestling with language, because at first it wasn't as straightforward or maybe as natural, you know, even though it was the language of your parents and your family, Gikuyu. Is it now, Yugi, much easier? Is the flow much easier writing in Gikuyu?
No, I'm all used to it now. So that little devil is not the same way.
Yes.
I mean, because they at prison, the devil was real, because you're frustrated. Because you're used to thinking one language, English. So words had to come in that language. So when you come to a new term and you don't have any coil, it's like you might get frustrated. But then the English word is not telling, like the devil brings the word there in front of you. Ah, but I'm here. Why, Gobi, why are you? I'm sorry. But I was like, why are you? You know, I'm here ready for you. So it's very easy to kind of, let me grab it and continue. No. Yeah.
So has there been a shift in Gugi? Do you now think and remember?
Yeah, no, yeah. The devil doesn't do that much in these days. Yeah. I even gave a lecture the other day in Gikuyu. I got a prize, a literary prize in Spain. And I spoke in Gikuyu. And I felt very good accepting the prize in the Gikuyu language. And it was broadcast in Gikuyu, but they had to put subtitles on television screens. Right.
Progress.
And I felt good. The devil is not really around me as much as it used to be. In prison, it's real.
And does writing in Gikuyu give you a freedom particular to the language, to its resonance or its history?
Yeah, now I can explore more things. I feel more free to play around with the language more. I'm struggling to use the language. When I wrote that novel, I was struggling to even use the language as a for creative imagination. Struggling, right, to accept the words, right, or to find the words, right. Now, I don't have that. Let me say, the English devil is not there anymore. Yeah.
That decision that you made to write books in Gikuyu was 50 or so years ago. Right. Has there since been, do you feel, a sufficient awakening among African writers and scholars who've since turned to and returned to their African languages? Yeah. Or is it slower going than you imagined?
It's still going, but still better than when I wrote. You know, what happened was that after I published my novels in Gikuyu, I also gave some lectures in New Zealand, Auckland, which I published under the title Decolonizing the Mind. And I never knew that text would resonate with many people all over the world. Yeah, from Native Americans, Hawaiian writers, Maori writers, you know, because speaking to a colonial situation where language was used as a way of destroying a people's sense of themselves, right? Whether it's Native American, Native Canadians, or Native Australians, New Zealanders, all in some European languages also, it's a global phenomenon, okay? Yeah, and people forget, we are made to forget that you don't have to, knowing another language should not be conditioned on your forgetting yours or being humiliated for your language, okay? But that if you know your mother tongue, okay, this is where I put it. If you know all the languages of the world and you don't know your mother tongue or the language of your culture, that is enslavement. But if you know your mother tongue or the language of your culture and add to it all the language of the world, that is empowerment, you know. And colonialism was not about empowerment. It was about the other way around. It was enslavement. Now I know Gikuyu. I can write in Gikuyu. I can write in Kiswahili. I can write in English. And I wish I knew Spanish or Yoruba or Zulu, right? But anyway, there's no contradiction in my knowing my mother tongue and adding other languages to it, right? It's giving more power. But to be humiliated for speaking your mother tongue, it's horrible, right? It's your mother tongue. You should add to it. But you know, all colonial, whether in Kenya, but also they happen also in New Zealand, you know, in Canada, in America, same pattern where children were actually humiliated and punished for speaking their mother tongue in a school compound, right? What does it mean to humiliate a child for speaking their mother tongue? And to reward that child for speaking another language, right? Yeah. And this is what, to me, when I look at the world today, that's one of the serious problems. Because all over the world, some languages are marginalized. But it's using the wrong assumption that to create a nation, you must have one language. Yes, to be nice to have one language of communication across many languages, that's all right. But it's not predicated on forgetting or being uprooted from your mother tongue. It's wrong in Wales, it was wrong in Ireland, it was wrong in Scotland, it was wrong in Northern Scandinavian countries and so on, right? Yeah. It was wrong when Japan colonized Korea 1910 to 1945 and they imposed Japanese language and Japanese names on the Koreans. Yeah. And it's wrong in America, North and South, right? Yeah.
As I mentioned in Gigi earlier, it was writing and putting on a play in a community theatre that got you thrown in prison in the 1970s. But last year, that play, Ngahika Ndinda, or I Will Marry When I Want, was performed in Nairobi finally at the National Theatre in both Gikuyu and English. How did you feel sitting in the audience?
No, I was not there myself. I wish I was there.
How did you feel hearing about the fact?
I was in California, but obviously I was very glad to see so many people, young generation. Because remember, there were some who were Remember, it was banned 45 years ago. So the children who were born when the play was on were now in their 50s. I mean, right? So there are many people in Kenya who had never seen the play, who have heard about it, but they never saw it, right? And now it was being done in National Theatre. Of course, the only difference, and quite a major one, is that whereas ours was really based in a village community among working people, this one was done by professional actors. Yeah. More, well, or semi-professional actors in Nairobi. Yeah. But I was so glad that it's back. And they are telling me that they might do even another one of mine again, which was not allowed. It's called Mother Sing For Me, My Tojugera. They are doing it again in Nairobi, in Gikuyu and English. Yeah. So that was not even allowed. That one, we're going to perform that one, the National Theatre. But this time, they even locked us out, actually physically locked us out of the theatre. And they put armed policemen. It surrounded the theater. I mean, it was horrible, right? Mm. So they're doing it again, Mother Sing For Me, right? So I'm very excited.
I wanted to read out something you wrote in Birth of a Dreamweaver. It's this: I grew up in a race-structured society where white was wealth, power, and privilege, and black was poverty, impotence, and burden, where white was indolence, and black was diligence, a society where white harvested what blacks planted.
Yeah.
Between your long stretches of absence, Ngugi, how has Kenya changed since your growing up?
No, it did not reach. Okay. Okay. Was, if you look at the whole world today, the globe right now, is structured in the same way, right? It's pyramid, whether here in America or somewhere else. Pyramid means by definition that only a few people can be at the top of the pyramid, right? That there will be more people at the base of the pyramid than a few others in the middle. Huh? A very few, tiny minority at the top, right? The difference, though, is in the case of the colony, that whether you're at the bottom or middle or at the top was purely based on race, right? Meaning black people, African people as a whole, occupy the bottom of the pyramid, Asians or, you know, well, more or less in the middle of the pyramid, and Europeans at the top of the pyramid, right? That is still, in terms of pyramid structure of our society, that's still true today. Huh? In America, it's the same thing. A few people at the top of the pyramid. Yeah. In Kenya, in the post, the difference, though, is in a way the racial barriers, the movement up and down the pyramid remained, and removed, right? But the pyramid structure, all that sort of remains. Yeah? So it doesn't matter whether, I mean, it matters, of course, but if the structure is so that remains the same, a few people at the top. The only difference now is that those few people at the top can be black and African, but the majority are still at the bottom of the pyramid, right? That's a problem. Most working people in the world occupy the bottom of the pyramid of most societies. You look at America, the people they call, in America, they measure everybody by millionaireship. I don't know, it's a weird thing, but millionaires. But the people, there are only very few, I'm told there are very few millionaires or billionaires or trillionaires, and the few people at the top, 10 of them or so, have more money than the rest of the society combined together or something. I mean, something which is difficult to, even to imagine, but that's the reality, yeah. But I'm saying that structure tends to be there everywhere in the given, okay, in our capitalist society, it is there. The difference is that in a colonial society, or where there is races, that also has been complicated or governed by race. Yeah.
Gigi, your life spanned a time when colonial empires have been crumbling and new nations being born, and it's given you this rich seam of material for your writing, but it's also given you, at least in early life, you describe as a time spent nervously looking over my shoulder in constant fear of falling victim to the gun-toting British forces that were everywhere. That's from the House. I wanted to ask you about how you've managed to keep your writing considered and balanced and calm too. And is that who you are, or have you had to really work on not becoming kind of too
damaged? No, I think there are children everywhere. I've sometimes seen pictures of people fighting Palestine, or people being, or when there's war in the Middle East or Iraq war, and you see children playing on those trucks. Yeah.
Tanks or, yeah.
Yeah, tanks, yeah. I mean, all of our children are playing there, right? You say, oh my God. And yeah. And you, I look at it, and say, oh my God, do they know what they're doing? But they're playing, right? In other words, life refuses to be, life fights back in a way. And when I see those children, right? When I see those children playing at times, at first you feel, oh no. And then, yeah, they are refusing to die. That's very amazing to me. And I try to get inspiration from that. I look at Kenya and I ask myself, how is it without any weapons to speak of? They could think they could fight against the British, go to war against the British in Kenya with everything, right? They're the state machinery, they're the soldiers, they're the policemen, they're the guns, they're weaponry.
Yes.
Wow. So I'm still amazed. Because if you look at America, for instance, both all America, from Canada, from North America to, it's very interesting that in all the early settler colonies all over the world, it's the settlers, it's the colonizers who say, they are now independent, not the colonized.
Mm.
Okay. Not the colonized. In America, it's not the Native Americans who were colonized who say now we got our independence. In New Zealand, it's not the Maoris who say we are independent. In Canada, it's the same thing. It's not the Native Canadians or Native Australians who say they are independent. It's the colonists, generally. Who now say they are independent. I mean, right? So, and this was a trend that was going on in the world. Kenya was the first to fight against that trend of white settler colonies somehow becoming independent under the same colonial.
Yes.
Kenya, right? Because South Africa was going that way, but Kenya was the first to stand up and resist that, to break the whole trend, break that tendency, which was in Canada, in America, South America, Australia, New Zealand, Kenya. Yeah. So I'm very proud of my Kenyan ancestors, but I'm amazed what made them think they could do it. That's what amazes me all the time. What made them dare? Yeah.
And you're returning to the idea of home in your book, In the House of the Interpreter. You write this after your family home, as you said earlier, was destroyed by the British, and you return to see this new place where your family has been forced to move to. And you wrote, I was going to live out my life in a home that reminded me of the loss of home, and in school that offered shelter, but not the certainty of home. Both, ironically, were colonial constructs. And that those are your words, Ngugi. And I felt like that paradox does appear quite constantly in your life and hasn't gone away also, because young Kenyans today are facing some of the same issues you face. The best education is still in institutions set up by the former colonial powers, for example. And change is so slow, isn't it?
What am I in America? I was forced out of Kenya. Where did I get a job? But at Yale, as a visiting professor of English and comparative literature. New York University, professor of English, of comparative literature in English, of course. And of course, here in America, California, University of California, Irvine. You know, I'm professor of English and comparative literature. The paradoxes are always there. I'm here in America, professor of English, writing in Kikuyu language, and my big novel, Wizard of the Crow, I wrote in Kikuyu. So there are all those paradoxes. I grew up in a house of storytelling, but the novels in English are the one who gave me the freedom to tell myself stories. I could read stories for myself, but most of them were written in English at the time.
Yes.
Dickens.
I was moved also, Ngugi, by how you, at a very young age, you realized the importance of community when you lost your family home, when you lost your village, actually, where your family's home was. And you searched for a sense of belonging through volunteering groups and even initiated ways of bringing people together through song and societies. You wrote this, you said, "It could be that I was still looking for a community to replace the home I had lost." Have you found a sense of belonging?
No, now actually, I think in terms of search for language, I was very, I was very moved when there was a Native American writer,
yes,
from Colombia, who was in Quechua, and she flew all the way here to California to see me. Why? Not because of my novels, but because of what I had said about language in the colonized mind, right?
Yes.
It resonates with her,
yeah,
right? Now they're in Quechua and in Spanish,
yes,
right? I once went to India some 3 or 5 years ago, I don't remember, Calcutta. It was one of my publishers in Calcutta. And when the native speakers of, because India has also very many languages, but small language, when they had, I was there, seven leaders of seven language communicating to see me, right? Yeah. Why? Because of the colors in the mind, right? Hawaii, the same thing. I have a similar reception in Hawaii. I had a similar reception among the Maori people in New Zealand, right? Yeah. The lecture decolonized the mind, speak to them. That's why they identify with it, right? Yeah. So when I've lost home, but in essence, I'm a part of another larger community of language struggles all over the world. Yeah.
In The Perfect Nine, you wrote this about one of the daughters in the book, and I quote, "I too will follow the dictates of my heart the same way you once did." And she says this speaking to her parents. "I will go out in the world to find my own Makurawaini," which was the name you gave of the place her family called home.
Yeah.
I wondered if you think you might live in Kenya again.
Oh, I want to. I'm now 85 and I still keep dreaming of relocating Kenya. I'd love to. I meet the five. I will live long enough to rock it in Kenya. I don't, it's just, it was always my dream to retire in Kenya. And if I can do it, if the political situation allows me, I'll go back.
Gigi, I wanted to finish up by asking about what you're writing. And I think you're currently writing something about your time when you were at the University of Leeds in the UK. Can you tell me
anything? I've not written that yet. I have had, sorry about that, but I've had kidney failure. Kidneys. My kidneys have failed.
Oh my goodness.
So I'm struggling to get back on my feet. Yeah. So once I get back on my feet, I want to write one more memoir of my years in Leeds, because it was a very important period of my life.
Okay.
Between 1966, 65, and 1967 or 68. Right, it was a very important period, both for me, but also in world history at the time. Also my awakening, coming to contact with writers like Frantz Fanon, The Nature of the Earth, or coming to contact with Marx, and so on, right? It was a very important period in my life. But I'd like to do one more novel in Gikuyu, just one more novel in Gikuyu. Oh, just one more.
Ngugi, thank you so much for taking
the time. Oh, thanks so much,
And my thanks to the supporter of this podcast, Cox and Kings. Goodbye.